this is your lucky day. You have the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to pay amazingly high prices for some incredibly worthless stuff. Just keep listening, and we'll tell you over and 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 over.
Aren't you glad this is KBOO? KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Non-commercial.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, Democratic presidential candidate and presumptive nominee Joe Biden has finally announced his vice presidential selection, and it is California Senator Kamala Harris. Biden had taken an extraordinarily long time to make a decision with dozens of candidates and a very detailed vetting process. He had made clear he wanted to pick a female running mate and faced pressure from advocacy groups demanding that he choose a black female VP. His choice of Harris, the daughter of an Indian woman and Jamaican father, appeared to satisfy several demands for racial and gender representation, while protecting him from Republican accusations of being anti-police, anti-Wall Street, or anti-Israel. Harris, the former California Attorney General, faces accusations from the left of being too easy on abusive police and on big banks and mortgage lenders while she held that role. She's also faced criticism of being too pro-Israel as a senator. Harris, who was also a presidential candidate alongside Biden, had initially endorsed Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan, which Biden vehemently opposes but is largely favored by the public. She had then quickly backtracked and offered a watered-down version of the bill. Still, others on the left, such as academic and historian Manisha Sinha, author of The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition, lauded Biden's choice of Harris in a New York Times op-ed. Dr. Sinha compared Harris to Barack Obama, saying they both, quote, represent the cosmopolitan interracial democracy that a majority of Americans aspire to live in today. Fox News host Chris Wallace proclaimed that Harris, quote, doesn't do any harm to Biden's chances in the November election. Biden and Harris planned a joint speaking event in Delaware on Wednesday after raising a record number of small donations in the wake of the VP announcement. In other election news, Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar just won her first primary challenge 2 years after becoming one of the two first Muslim American women in Congress. Omar, a Somali American former refugee, has faced attacks from Republicans as well as the center right of the Democratic Party. She handily defeated a well-funded Democratic opponent named Antone Melton Moe. Omar is considered one of the squad of four freshman progressive and outspoken congresswomen of color elected in 2018. All four, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib, beat back primary challengers this year. In notable Republican primary wins, a far-right conspiracy theorist who has made racist statements on video won a GOP primary in Georgia. Marjorie Taylor Greene is an avowed supporter of the QAnon conspiracy group, whose accounts have been removed from numerous social media platforms. She won the race for Georgia's 14th congressional district. President Donald Trump congratulated her on Twitter as a, quote, future Republican star. Trump's weekend announcements to sign four executive orders on financial relief for Americans struggling from the pandemic are being met with skepticism. Only one was actually an executive order on housing, And even that does not actually extend a federal eviction moratorium as it has been cast as doing. His payroll tax holiday, which is meant to temporarily make more money available to working Americans, excludes tens of millions of unemployed Americans who need the most help. And it requires working people to pay back the deferred taxes next year, creating a logistical and confusing nightmare for employers, the IRS, and the Social Security Administration. His extension of jobless benefits reduces the weekly amount from $600 to $300 a week and requires that cash-strapped states kick in an additional $100 a week. And his student loan order only defers interest payments on loans and only until the end of the year. Meanwhile, Congress remains deadlocked. Russia has approved the first COVID-19 vaccine, with President Vladimir Putin announcing on Tuesday that it, quote, works quite effectively. The vaccine, called Sputnik V, has not even completed clinical trials, leading experts to treat it with extreme caution. Dr. Anthony Fauci is among the skeptics and said, quote, having a vaccine and proving that a vaccine is safe and effective are two different things. Meanwhile, companies in the U.S. are testing the use of COVID-19 antibodies to provide immunity while vaccine trials continue. AP explained the difference, saying, quote, antibodies are proteins the body makes when an infection occurs. They attach to a virus and help it be eliminated. Vaccines work by tricking the body into thinking there's an infection, so it makes antibodies and remembers how to do that if the real bug turns up. New research offers definitive evidence of what scientists have been saying all along, that airborne transmission is a significant method of the virus's spread. The New York Times summarized the study, saying that floating respiratory droplets called aerosols contain live virus and not just fragments of the genetic material. The particles were collected at a distance of 7 to 16 feet from infected patients, suggesting that social distancing alone is not enough to curb the spread of the virus, and that masks that trap respiratory droplets are necessary. The study did not determine if the amount of live virus collected in the air was enough to trigger infection. Meanwhile, a separate study of different face coverings shows that fitted N95 masks continue to be the most effective at stopping viral particles, while homemade cotton cloth face coverings were second best, as good as surgical masks. Bandanas and knitted masks are not as effective, and so-called neck gaiters made from stretchy, breathable fabric are possibly worse than no mask at all. In Florida, where COVID-19 infections continue to break records, Marion County Sheriff Billy Woods has banned his staff from wearing masks, claiming there is no consensus on their safety. In Georgia, where schools have reopened with largely no masks or social distancing, nearly 1,000 people have already been ordered to quarantine after a week. Seattle's Police Chief Carmen Best has announced she is retiring on September 2nd. Her announcement came at the same time as Seattle City Council voted unanimously to cut police funding and reduce law enforcement by as many as 100 officers. In Portland, Oregon, where Black Lives Matter protests were violently targeted by President Trump's federal officers, many will not face charges. The city has announced a new policy on Tuesday that hundreds of people arrested on nonviolent misdemeanor charges will not be prosecuted. Colorado's Attorney General has announced a new civil rights investigation into the Aurora Police Department, whose officers killed 23-year-old Elijah McClain last year. McClain's parents have filed a lawsuit over their son's death. In Florida, a state known for arresting very small children in schools, Key West police arrested an 8-year-old boy for hitting his teacher, a boy so small that the handcuffs were too large for his wrists. And in California, a new poll finds strong public appetite for police reforms. The LA Times explained that 80% of respondents favored passing laws that would make it easier to prosecute police officers who use excessive force. 78% favored banning officers from using chokeholds and strangleholds when detaining suspects. 70% favored granting civilians the right to sue officers for misconduct and excessive force, and 61% favored limiting the power of police unions by reducing their collective bargaining rights. Finally, six former heads of the Environmental Protection Agency, which is most living former EPA directors, have joined a call for an agency reset, once President Trump is out of office. The former agency heads served under Democratic and Republican administrations, and they've backed a series of detailed recommendations made by the Environmental Protection Network in a document entitled Resetting the Course of EPA. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump's executive order that was meant to extend a federal eviction moratorium due to the COVID-19 pandemic actually does very little. While Trump claimed it would, quote, solve that problem largely, hopefully completely, others have said it will do nothing to help the tens of millions of Americans that are on the precipice of homelessness. Unemployment is widespread, and with relief payments expiring and rent payments due, the U.S. appears to be on the brink of a massive housing crisis that is unprecedented in the modern era. My guest is Zach Newman, founder of the COVID-19 Eviction Defense Project. He's a lawyer whose practice focuses on landlord-tenant debt collection and wage dispute cases. He's also a public policy lecturer at Colorado University Denver's School of Public Affairs, and he writes about jobs and economic issues at the Aspen Institute. Welcome to the program, Zach.
Thanks, Sonali. It's great to be on today.
So what is the reason that we might be facing this crisis now and not, say, in April or May or June?
Yeah, well, I think we're at a really interesting and challenging intersection of the COVID-19 moment. Obviously, right after COVID was discovered, or it kind of arrived in the United States, Congress passed the CARES Act, which provided fairly rigorous financial support for families and individuals who were displaced from employment by the disease. At the same time, state governments and the federal government put various eviction moratoria in place, protecting tenants from being removed from their homes. So you had multiple forms of protections for renters in the United States. One form was that landlords could not evict them, but then they were also receiving money, which presumably allowed them to pay their bills. Now we're in a moment where all of that has changed. The federal moratorium is no longer in place. That expired a few weeks ago. Most states in the United States have also discontinued their various moratoria. And then the CARES Act funding, which included stimulus checks at the beginning, and then for people who lost their jobs, federally enhanced UI, unemployment insurance, has also been discontinued. So tenants across the U.S. who have lost their work due to COVID-19 aren't receiving any additional funds from the government. They, for the most part, are not protected by eviction moratoria. And so now they're in a situation where there's no more money coming in. They've not gone back to work, and eviction courts are open for business.
The relief that was made available to renters initially, I understand, was never actually rent forgiveness, right? It was just, okay, we'll allow you to defer paying your rent. And are there large numbers of Americans that have very big bills of back payments for rent that they are faced with now?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So none of the state or the federal moratoria allowed tenants to not pay their rent. It didn't defer bills at all. The rent was still due. It just meant that if you were unable to pay your rent, you couldn't be evicted. But now you have tenants all across the United States who not only are no longer enjoying those protections, but in many cases have significant rental debt or rental arrears that they owe their landlord. And now being unable to pay, it means that their landlords are likely to begin eviction proceedings in those cases. Which is scary for those tenants. I mean, these are folks, again, who've not had a chance to go back to work. Government benefits have been discontinued. And so I think you have a lot of renters around the country asking the question, what do I do next?
So the executive order that Trump signed on eviction relief, supposedly, over the weekend, what exactly does it do? As I mentioned, Trump claims that it may solve the problem entirely. Others have said it's going to do absolutely nothing. If you read the executive order, it instructs the secretaries of Health and Human Services and Housing and Urban Development to go, you know, as far as they can to provide assistance, but it doesn't actually, as far as I can tell, extend the federal eviction moratorium.
No, it doesn't. And I would say it's actually worse than nothing, because what we're hearing from our clients now is, I'm okay. There's a new eviction moratorium in place. The president implemented it last week. Everything is great. So I can go on living where I'm living. And we're now in the really uncomfortable position of having to tell our clients, no, actually, this is not an eviction moratorium. It doesn't provide any additional protections. And you really do have to address the situation right now because you are facing eviction. And so if anything, it's muddied the waters rather than done anything to protect tenants.
When we talk about the kinds of relief that is actually needed right now, what are you recommending needs to happen? Because of course there are landlords that have to pay their mortgages. There are unemployed Americans that need housing but have no money coming in, mostly for no fault of their own because we're in a pandemic. Some have suggested an eviction moratorium. Others have said rent forgiveness. You know, there's a whole variety of options out there, some of which are more effective and others are less effective. What do you recommend needs to happen?
Yeah, it's a really frightening moment for millions of Americans. I think fundamentally we need to do two things, one at the federal level and one at the state level. At the state level, we need our state governments to buy people time. They need to re-implement state eviction moratoria across the U.S. And ensure that people cannot be evicted during the pandemic. And then at the same time, Congress needs to get its act together and begin work on finally passing a second wave of the CARES Act or the previously considered HEROES Act and include in that $100 billion plus in rental relief for tenants so that they can pay their landlords. And, you know, this helps tenants, it keeps them housed, but it also helps landlords. A lot of mom and pop landlords in the U.S. now are facing multi-month rental arrears. They themselves can't pay their mortgages, they can't pay to maintain the properties. And so if Congress takes action and puts real money in the hands of tenants, it means that the entire housing sector in the U.S. is stabilized. And so that's the second piece of it, and arguably the most important piece in that it stabilizes everyone in the equation.
What do you know about the numbers of people that are facing eviction over the next month or two? And is there, I imagine, geographic disparity, some states where you'll see a much worse situation than others?
So the numbers are staggering. They're almost unbelievable. You know, we created through the Aspen Institute an economic model that looks at this, and it uses U.S. Census Bureau Pulse Survey data. And the U.S. Census Bureau Pulse Survey asked renters two questions. One, were you able to pay your rent last month fully and on time? And then two, how confident are you next month that you'll be able to make that same payment? And each month through the COVID crisis, that number has gone up. And now what we're looking at is somewhere in the range of 30 to 40 million Americans who may not be able to fully pay their rent on time. So it's an incredibly large number. Even scarier is that this number is more pronounced in certain parts of the country where COVID-19 has returned more aggressively, where you don't traditionally have a history of strong tenant protections. So folks are facing eviction more rapidly than they would in other states. And then, of course, also the data suggests that if you are Black or Latinx, your odds of facing eviction or certainly having concerns about being able to pay your rent are nearly double those of white Americans.
There are states that already experienced housing crises. I'm in California, which for years has had this crisis building up about the cost of housing just becoming more and more out of reach for ordinary Californians. Similar situations in other states have arisen as well. So I imagine that what we're facing now is only exacerbating, pouring fuel on a fire that was raging.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, rental costs in the U.S. have been out of step with income for decades. And now you're putting people in a position where they don't even have income and rental prices are still very high. So you know, borrowing from family members, taking high interest loans from payday lenders or credit cards, even those very unattractive options don't necessarily allow tenants to pay their rent. So it is very quickly becoming a crisis moment for millions of Americans.
I mean, what will happen to them? Do you expect homelessness is essentially going to explode because short of shelters taking people in, which are already overwhelmed and are temporary, there are no other options, are there? Or I imagine there's also massive displacement that's going to rise. People are going to try to move to places where they might be able to afford rent.
Yeah, you know, it's not clear what will happen. I think in some of these cases, you will have landlords say, I'm going to forgive or dramatically reduce your rent to keep you on the property because I don't think I can get another tenant. I think in some cases, you'll have people who've seen wage reductions, but not total wage loss, move out of their home or apartment and into a more affordable home or apartment. I think some people will move in with family members. Others will move to hotels. And then others will be made homeless by the moment. And whether that's short term or long term, that displacement will be very real. So I think, you know, we'll see how this situation plays out over the next 3 or 4 months. But generally in these moments, you would expect to see tenants searching out a variety of different options when they're displaced from the rental unit that they're living in.
It's just remarkable to read President Trump's executive order on housing. A lot of words that actually amounts to almost nothing. Essentially, what he says is it is the policy of the United States to minimize to the greatest extent possible residential evictions and foreclosures. And it involves the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Director of the CDC. They should consider whether there are any measures temporarily halting residential evictions of any tenants for failure to pay rent are reasonably necessary. The Secretary of the Treasury and the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development should identify any and available federal funds to provide temporary financial assistance to renters and homeowners. So just basically look for money lying about, not actually have any funding made available that's concrete. And then taking action as appropriate and consistent with applicable law to promote the ability of renters and homeowners to avoid eviction or foreclosures resulting from financial hardships caused by COVID-19. I don't even know what that means, to promote the ability of renters to avoid eviction. I mean, you're a lawyer. What does that mean to you?
I mean, this is the whole problem with the executive order. The sentiment is actually a good one. We want to keep people in their homes. We want to avoid evictions. But this doesn't actually do anything. It doesn't change the playing field. It doesn't necessarily put funds in the pockets of tenants so they can pay their landlord's rent. It doesn't stop evictions in any meaningful way. So, you know, maybe as a sentiment, it's a positive one. But in terms of actually providing relief for people who may soon be homeless, it does virtually nothing.
What is the advice that you're giving to people facing eviction? Because, of course, there are different laws depending upon and policies depending upon cities, depending upon states. There's such a patchwork of rights that tenants have, right?
Yeah, this really varies by the city and the state you live in. And, you know, the divergences between, say, where we live in Colorado and folks who live in California or Washington are fairly dramatic. I think the one piece of advice that is true for every part of the country is if you are facing eviction, the number one thing you can do is speak to an attorney. In your city or state, there is likely a legal aid or a legal services office. Reaching out to that office early in the process, even as early as when you discover you're not going to be able to make your full rental payment, really, really, really makes a difference. It means that you're likely to get the best advice. You can understand better how to negotiate with your landlord. And generally speaking, tenants who have access to counsel have better outcomes. It doesn't necessarily mean you won't have to leave your home or apartment and move elsewhere, but you may be able to reduce the amount of debt you owe, or you may be able to buy yourself more time, or in many cases, you may actually be able to stay. So reaching out to a lawyer is the number one thing you can do, and it's something you want to do right away, as soon as you find you have issues with payment.
And of course, if you can't afford to pay rent, you can't afford to hire a lawyer. So I think, as you were saying, legal aid organizations that provide pro bono counseling and any other resources that are free. Now, of course, the housing crisis, this crisis of that we're on the brink of seeing, you know, tens of millions of Americans potentially becoming evicted, is intricately linked to unemployment. There are millions of Americans that have no jobs to go back to, or cannot go back to jobs because of the pandemic, and they might have vulnerable health issues, and they might have lost their health insurance, and they have no money coming in because Congress has basically deadlocked. It's critically important to just get money into people's hands, right, so that they can not just address all of their needs, but also remain in their homes. I mean, just getting money into the pockets of Americans during a crisis like this seems to be a critically important issue, one that certainly the Republicans don't get. And even Trump, who has approved federal unemployment benefits being extended, has only approved them at the level of $300 a week, half of what was being offered before.
Yeah, well, I think, again, putting money in the pockets of people who've lost wages or lost their employment entirely goes a long way in resolving this crisis. Obviously, for certain communities, those funds are not accessible, but for the vast majority of Americans, they are. And providing that money also means, again, that the whole housing sector is stabilized. If you provide more stimulus, if you provide full federally enhanced UI as provided under the First CARES Act, so that's $600 a week, or even if you provide rent relief, those funds let tenants pay their landlords, which means landlords can pay their mortgages, they can maintain properties. Mom and pop landlords who rely on properties for retirement income can access those funds. So really, this is not just about stabilizing tenants, although for us, that's clearly the most important part of the equation. It's about stabilizing the whole sector and ensuring that everyone can walk away from the COVID-19 moment whole.
What are housing, I don't know what to call them, investors, those moneyed interests that have holdings that depend on rent, so not the mom and pop renters, but the big renters, what are they demanding from the government? I imagine that they might be lobbying the government for some sort of economic relief.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are a number of industry groups in D.C. that work on behalf of large property owners. And almost uniformly, they also have been signaling that this is a crisis. So the National Apartment Association, as early as April, put out a letter to Congress saying that during the course of the COVID crisis, upwards of 25% of renters might need financial or economic support to stay housed. And then they've kind of doubled down on that request in support of things like rent relief, increased federally enhanced UI, and other provisions that allow tenants to pay their rent. One would assume, because it's good for the industry and it ensures that the properties their members own and manage are able to stay solvent.
If there is a massive amount of rent non-payment, are we going to see the housing costs going down and rents going down?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I think it depends on the market. Where I live in Denver, and more broadly in the state of Colorado, rental prices have started to decline. So you're starting to see cheaper rents. You're starting to also see multi-month kind of upfront free rent packages, things like that, to entice tenants. So efforts are being made by landlords to bring in new tenants by lowering prices. Now, whether this is a short-term phenomenon or it speaks to a longer-term trend, anyone's to say, but it has been something we've seen here in Colorado. Not sure what's happening in the rest of the country, although falling rent prices in properties across the country would not surprise me, given the scope of the crisis.
Aren't states also deeply limited in what they can do at this moment? Generally speaking, states have provided the kind of assistance that people who struggle with housing need. But because of the pandemic, the same reason that people are facing eviction or, you know, the inability to put food on the table, the states are also completely devastated financially. State budgets have been deeply slashed. Revenues have dropped as the tax base has dropped. And so there's less money at the state level to provide relief, right, for those people who are experiencing homelessness or might be on the verge of experiencing homelessness?
That's exactly right, yeah. So state budgets, for the most part, and there are some states that are outliers that may actually be able to make a significant dent in the problem, but most states, even under normal conditions, wouldn't have the bandwidth budget-wise to address the problem. And that's even more pronounced during this COVID-19 moment, where state budgets, which in many cases are supported by property taxes, are just not keeping up with the scale of the crisis. To give an example, here in Colorado, where I live, the state recently passed and implemented a $20 million rent relief fund. And we're certainly appreciative of that. The people who've accessed this money have benefited. It has kept them in their homes. And so, again, thankful for that money. But long-term modeling suggests that rental arrears in Colorado could reach $1 billion through the end of the COVID-19 crisis. And so, obviously, $20 million is about 2% of what may be needed. And so this is why we need the federal government to step in, because they've got the checkbook and the budget to actually make a significant dent in this problem and keep tenants housed.
Right. I mean, the federal government's intervention at a time of crisis that, you know, most Americans were not expecting is what's needed the most. But we have a executive branch that is perhaps the most loath to have any kind of federal government intervention in the modern era. I mean, there's been this ideology pervading, especially conservative thinking in this country, that any kind of government intervention is bad. But when you have a crisis like this, there is government intervention to help corporations, to help stabilize industries at the top, but not as much at the bottom. And it's quite shocking to me to see that even, you know, those people who realize that putting money in the pockets of Americans will help corporations ultimately, because people have to spend the money, are ideologically bound or binding themselves away from that and loath to suggest that the government needs to intervene. And it almost seems like this fundamentalism, you know, this fundamentalist thinking. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but it seems less practical and more ideological.
Yeah, well, it's a strange moment. You know, the first round of CARES Act funding for us was really surprising. It went further than we thought it would in terms of, you know, paying people's bills, ensuring they had very extensive access to unemployment insurance. Certainly for a lot of our clients, the stimulus check really helped. I think the issue now is that as negotiations proceed and, you know, Washington takes time to reach agreement, the first of the month, at the risk of sounding really simple, comes every 30 days. And so you already have tenants who on August 1st had issues paying. Maybe they pulled it together, maybe they didn't. But as negotiations proceed, we get closer and closer to September 1st. And the fear that we have as tenant advocates and as lawyers is that even if Congress passes something before September 1st, it's not clear that implementation will happen before this date. And so you could see a world where a package gets done, something is passed before the 1st, but that money doesn't make it out to unemployed tenants until well after the 1st. And because eviction moratoria are not in place in most states in the U.S. now, eviction proceedings begin. So the money is on the way, but while the money is on the way and being sent, tenants are in court, they're filing documents, they're receiving writs of restitutions, and they're getting evicted despite the fact that Congress finally got its act together and provided some funding.
Well, we are going to see what happens in the next few weeks or month. Give out a website where people can find out about the work you do, Zach.
Yeah, so we're the COVID-19 Eviction Defense Project. Our website is cedproject.org. I will say for everyone watching and listening, we only provide legal services in the state of Colorado, given bar rules and things of that nature. But our policy recommendations and our economic modeling, which I've alluded to, are national, and they go state by state, and those are included on our website.
Zach, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thanks for having me on. Really a pleasure to to be here and to get to chat with you today.
My guest has been Zach Newman, founder of the COVID-19 Eviction Defense Project based in Colorado. He's a lawyer whose practice focuses on landlord-tenant debt collection and wage dispute cases. He's also a public policy lecturer at Colorado University Denver's School of Public Affairs. He writes about jobs and economic issues at the Aspen Institute. We've been discussing the massive eviction crisis that millions of Americans are on the verge of. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Many months into a global pandemic of staggering proportions, we're living in what could be viewed as not just a disaster, but a mega disaster. One that we as a society were ill-prepared for in terms of infrastructure and economy and healthcare and so much more. Disasters such as devastating earthquakes, terrorist attacks, industrial accidents, or nuclear war are so terrifying that our human psyche may be ill-equipped to imagine the scale of the resulting crisis. But in order to be resilient, we must prepare. And joining me to share his guide on how to prepare is Jeffrey Slegamelch, Deputy Director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Earth Institute. He previously worked for the Yale New Haven Health System Center for Emergency Preparedness and Disaster Response and the Boston Public Health Commission. He's written a new book called Rethinking Readiness, a brief guide to 21st century mega disasters. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Thank you for having me. Great to talk with you today.
So what constitutes a mega disaster as opposed to a disaster?
Yeah, so there's a lot of terms we use in disaster science that sort of have fuzzy edges to them, like resilience and things like that. But when I think of mega disasters, I like to think of that as disasters that are of such a scale that they disrupt the very systems that are designed to manage those disasters. They kind of break our disaster response infrastructure. And in this book and in some of the catastrophes we've seen throughout history, there are mega disasters of an even greater scale that not only sort of break those response systems, but also alter the trajectory of human history.
So I imagine the recent explosion in Beirut, Lebanon, might qualify as a mega disaster. The grain silo devastated. There's no sense of where, how people are going to get fed, where 300,000 displaced people are going to live.
Absolutely. And you also see the resignation of a government as a result of this and really repercussions not only throughout the country, but throughout the region to an extent that we're not even entirely sure of yet in these early days after the explosion. So certainly a disaster of very significant proportions and one that, you know, of course, our hearts are with those affected by this and the true damage remains to be seen.
And then you have our COVID-19 pandemic that we're living through, which seems to be a much more slow-moving disaster, but a disaster nonetheless. It's expected that 200,000 Americans will have died from the disease before the end of the year. So it's not something that just broke it like a massive explosion, but a slow-moving disaster where we saw what was coming and appeared completely unprepared, at least in this country, to handle it.
Yeah, and with pandemics like COVID-19, although COVID-19 itself was a surprise, the idea of a pandemic affecting the United States at this scale was not a surprise to anyone. And in fact, periodically throughout history, this is one of those, you know, age-old mega disasters that we see time and time again throughout the course of history. You know, a lot of eyes were on influenza because we tend to see influenza pandemics. Of course, there's the plague of the Middle Ages, among many, many other pandemics. And it's certainly, unfortunately, having an effect that's far greater than perhaps it needed to be given the ability to see these things coming.
And therefore, your first chapter is entitled Bio Threats, right?
Yeah, and looks at both pandemics and these kind of naturally occurring, although that's probably a little bit of a misnomer, because although it's a natural disease outbreak, not an act of bioterrorism or antibiotic resistance or something like that, which we also talk about in the book, but it's a but it is emerging, jumping from, you know, animal populations to people due to encroachment in these different ecosystems, and then spreading very quickly through a much more interconnected world. So while the initial origin is from this kind of natural hazard, there's really very little that's natural about the spread and impact of the disease once it makes that jump to people, and even before.
So biothreats like deadly disease of the kind that we are grappling with today are, I imagine, as devastating as our societies are ill-prepared to meet them.
Yeah, and so with each of the disasters that we sort of frame out in these scenarios that I look at in the book, is really looking at how human activity is contributing to both the overarching threat and the underlying vulnerabilities. So what you describe is exactly correct, right? We are increasing this threat by, you know, having living and encroaching on these delicate ecosystems, these biodiverse areas, by having a more and more interconnected world. And we're also increasing our vulnerability by not adequately funding our early detection and public health response systems. And, you know, we're seeing this in shortages of personal protective equipment and ventilators because of the way we create global kind of just-in-time supply chains. And so these are all elements on where the way that we're developing society is contributing not only to the threat of something bad happening, but also our vulnerability and the level of damage that does to us while we attempt to respond to it.
And therefore, we can see in almost as a grand experiment why some countries in the world have managed to meet this crisis better than other countries, that even faced with the same threat, whether it was because their healthcare systems were better capable of meeting the disaster or that existing health conditions were not as bad as they are in the US, we see countries that have managed to meet the crisis with much more readiness, say Germany or New Zealand or Taiwan, than countries like the US, the UK, Brazil, etc., right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of different dynamics here. And one of those, of course, is the political dynamics. Now, there are some underlying cultural reasons. There was a great kind of roundup of behavioral science in Nature a couple of weeks ago, looking at, you know, how more collective societies are more likely to adopt sacrifices for the benefit of the community, more individualistic societies. Those are some headwinds in terms of implementing this. But we're also absolutely seeing some political headwinds where we're seeing inconsistency in messaging coming from different government agencies and government offices, and in particularly from the administration in the United States. We're also seeing less leveraging of available federal policies and programs that could be more useful and better utilized to help manage and distribute across different states, rather than have states competing for personal protective equipment and ventilators and life-saving equipment like that. As well as just kind of a bipartisan failure over the last several decades to invest properly in public health systems and healthcare systems, and to create a national capacity to respond to pandemics. There was a patchwork of teams cobbled together by different administrations in the past, but that sort of cohesive, comprehensive approach to pandemic planning and pandemic response still eludes us even to this day.
I mean, we basically had decades of defunding of social safety nets, of the kinds of programs that would have made the US a much more resilient society. Is COVID-19 a preview of our unpreparedness or lack of preparedness around climate change, which is the topic of your second chapter? Many of us thought that the disaster we would be living through would be first and foremost climate change, because of course, unlike the federal government, who was briefed on the fact that a pandemic can arise any moment, most ordinary people weren't thinking about a disease, but we were thinking about climate change.
Yeah, and I would actually say that we were experiencing the impacts of climate change in its earlier stages before COVID-19 and during COVID-19. We're seeing the increased wildfires out west. We're seeing different dynamics in terms of extreme weather events, hurricanes carrying more water, greater wind speed, this potentially adding additional destabilization to parts of the world. These are things that are happening now and were happening even before COVID-19. The acceleration of that is a little bit slower and a little bit longer tailed than that of the COVID-19 pandemic. But you're absolutely right. I mean, these are all disasters. And while, you know, the book introduces these different scenarios as a way to sort of contextualize, it's really these cross-cutting issues. It's things like having these comprehensive views, looking at how development affects our these threats and vulnerabilities, managing uncertainty, dealing with complex scientific information. It's not, you can't distill that down into a tweet or a bumper sticker for what should be done. It's more complex than that. But I also just want to touch on, I mean, you mentioned a lot of these underlying issues in terms of resilience for a society. And I think that's a really important point, because when we talk about building resilience and building preparedness, it's not just about having duct tape and a week's worth of food and water or something like that. It's about looking at these social inequalities within our society, who has access to healthcare and who doesn't, who are the essential workers who have to go to work, who are the people who can afford to stay home because they're in a job that affords them that, or they have sick leave and things like that. All of these things contribute. They set the table to how the disasters play out. And too often, and in climate change and with COVID-19, we're seeing it disproportionately affect communities of color, people of lower socioeconomic status, and widening these inequalities. And it's a very different pandemic depending on where you sit in this country and on this planet.
And then you can have other unexpected disasters like what you deem critical infrastructure failure, a train getting derailed, a dam bursting. I point out Flint, Michigan's water crisis as one example. These seem to be more directly the failure of government preparedness.
Yeah, and this is sort of a growing threat that we have as well, too. You know, it's really great to cut ribbons and debut new highways, and there's nothing really politically, salient about maintaining a highway or maintaining an infrastructure. And here we have with some of the examples talked about in the book, the Oroville Dam in California, where you had more than 200,000 people evacuated overnight. Thankfully, the dam did not fail, but if it did fail, you would have 200,000 people, internally displaced refugees within the United States, who could not return home if that dam had failed. In Flint, Michigan, you had calls for evacuating the city of Flint if children couldn't be protected. This chronic exposure of an entire population to a contaminant that's a result of a failure of infrastructure. So I think, too, that failed infrastructure is about more than inconvenient power outages and potholes in the road, but there are actually looming mega disasters creating the potential for the kind of response domestically that we previously, in the U.S. at least, have really only thought about in terms of international humanitarian assistance.
We recently passed the 75th anniversaries of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, the atomic bombings, nuclear conflict, which is something that seems abstract. Because we haven't had it in many decades, is still a very real threat, is it not? Particularly given that nuclear weapons remain, they exist, they're proliferating. We don't talk about them very much. We talked about them briefly during the Obama administration. There was an appetite to start to draw down the weaponry that seems to have taken a complete backseat. And it is still a very real thing, even though we may not think about it, the prospect of a nuclear war.
Yeah, absolutely. And as long as there are nuclear weapons in this world, there's the potential for their use. And in many ways, the potential for their use has increased rather than diminished since the end of the Cold War. But the threat that we're facing has also changed. Instead of these global posturing of superpowers with global killing arsenals pointed at each other, it really made preparedness for something like this irrelevant. If there was a war between the Soviet Union and the United States, that's pretty much game over for everybody on the planet. Now, when we're talking about rogue nations, the prospect of nuclear terrorism and the kind of weapons that are in the hands more likely to be used, we start to get to these smaller kind of kiloton weapons that would cause a lot of damage, but also with the right kind of preparedness, it could be the difference of hundreds of thousands of lives for folks getting out of the way of the fallout, doing the right kind of sheltering and then evacuation as a result of this. So it's a very different threat, although it still persists to this day. But it's a very, very difficult one. How do you have a conversation? How does a mayor or a governor have a conversation with its constituents about how to deal with a modern nuclear threat? It's just something that is either too complicated to deal with or just not the top concern on folks' minds, but it's something we shouldn't forget. Sure.
Right. It seems to be just an issue of political will. A nuclear weapons, a nuclear war, you know, how to prevent it is not a very complicated thing. You want to prevent nuclear war, you get rid of nuclear weapons. And of course, it's just the reluctance of political leaders to want to do that. And the threat to societies doesn't seem to be a concern for those who have their finger close to the button. It's just really remarkable.
Yeah, and strategically, it's such a powerful situation to be in. I've heard the expression in the past, right, that for many nations, the ideal number of nuclear states is one, right? Mm-hmm. And whenever you're not sure, you have to have that deterrent, to have that threat. Unfortunately, we've painted ourselves in this corner where strategically it's very difficult to remove that. But on the flip side, it creates this ever-present threat. And the less we pay attention to the accessibility of nuclear materials and the accessibility of nuclear weapons, the more likely it is that they're going to get in the hands of someone who is maybe less hesitant in using them, or that we might catch ourselves on a bad day during a bad time doing something that we shouldn't. So absolutely agree.
Let's talk about cyber threats, which you also address in your book. What could, you know, cyber threats actually look like? Our world today is very much dependent on digital technologies, which are convenient and can be, to an extent, fail-safe, but also incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah, you know, there are kind of these doomsday scenarios from the Hollywood perspective of shutting down the grid for years and permanently, you know, shutting things down. And these kinds of things are actually a little less plausible given the number of manual overrides. What really makes cybersecurity so pervasive and such a dynamic threat is that it there's a lot of reasons, but one in particular that I found interesting in researching for the book is how it can be used as a complement to nation states and their strategic forces and their strategic approaches. Instead of having to have a fight on a battlefield, you can do something much more covert. So we'll give the example of the 2016 election, where there was a lot of evidence of Russian interference and attempts to go in there and do things like change the roles of folks showing up for an election. Now, because of the way that elections are run and compartmented in this country, it's not really likely that they're going to be able to that anyone's going to be able to change the result of a national election by hacking into a few voting machines. But if you start changing people's voter rolls and they show up to cast their vote and they're not on the list, and on top of that, you have a lot of heated rhetoric about how there's a lot of voter fraud and how your vote doesn't count, regardless of whether there's any evidence for that, in which case, and it's worth saying there is no evidence for widespread voter fraud, even though that's being projected. What that does is that starts to undermine democracy itself in this country. And that's much more insidious and much more pervasive. So some of the scenarios talked about in the book do talk about sort of the complexity of attacks, against the nuclear facility in Iran, against the Ukrainian power grid, as well as some physical damage that can be caused by overriding certain safety systems in generators and other pieces with moving parts. But really this complement, this component of kind of asymmetrical warfare for nation states opens up a whole new avenue in terms of vulnerability that I don't think is fully understood. And states and individuals and companies are on the front lines of this. So it's not a national problem. It's really the localities are on the front lines of a lot of this. And I'm not sure that we're adequately prepared to deal with an assault at that level on that magnitude.
Jeff, I'm wondering whether we as humans are equipped psychologically to imagine these disasters in order to be really ready for them. I mean, I know, for example, every time we've covered the issue of climate change has been historically an issue that has felt so big that people have naturally, you know, really felt pessimistic about it. It's such a big issue. Our brains seem to have not evolved to a place where we can grasp the scale of disaster that can result. But in order to be resilient, in order to be prepared, we do have to imagine disasters beyond the scope of our own imagining, right?
Yeah, as well as to, you know, identify how we fit in with that. And I think, you know, with the book and probably everything that I've talked about up till now, there's probably some folks really into this who are, you know, really excited to read it. And a lot of other folks saying, oh, I've got so much stuff on my mind already. I don't need all this additional stuff on top of it. What can I do about nuclear war? What can I do about cybersecurity? And that's where the book sort of takes a turn more towards how do we reframe our thinking for these 21st century disasters. It's not about finding a precise solution. It's no longer about finding the right combination of words or tweet to resolve everyone's concerns. It's about managing uncertainty. And I think everyone is developing a lot of expertise in that right now with COVID-19, right? Everything from schools in the fall to going back to work to, you know, what's the transmission rate going to be tomorrow? We're dealing with a lot of uncertainty. And how do you create options? How do you create new frameworks that instead of trying to artificially pretend that uncertainty is not there, but actually embrace it. And instead of trying to create a solution, to create options that can be laid out as more information is available. And then integrating that into how we ourselves interact with civil society, as well as with our communities and with our families. One of the best things we can do is build social cohesion with our neighbors. Have a barbecue, check in on that person next to you. Socially distancing, of course, you know, do it outside, 6 feet apart. But
those rely on the sort of personal actions. I mean, don't we also need broader governmental policy change? We have this society that here in the United States deeply looks down upon, you know, social safety net, broad policies that actually help ordinary people. And we have rich, you know, a small handful of people getting rich at the expense of the rest of us. You know, capitalism seems to be a hindrance to resiliency. There also seems to me to be a requirement that people understand and agree that science is important. I mean, it seems ludicrous to even say that these days, considering how much we depend on science, scientific discovery, scientific technology, but there's so much skepticism these days. Are you worried that that impacts our resiliency and preparedness?
So I haven't looked directly at this data, but I've been told about some data that actually there's more trust in science than there ever has been in the past. But at the same time, the distrust, it's much more polarized. So the strong distrust is much more polarized. So the experience is, it seems that there's less and less trust in science. So it creates a very interesting dynamic. And I think in practical terms, which I agree with you, you're sort of at this point where some people are adhering to where the science is pointing us and others are just hard and fast denying it, and also having that perspective amplified by certain actors and sometimes even elected officials and folks in positions of power. But I have mixed feelings. On the one hand, I think that, you know, science is only going to get us so far. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, science doesn't give us the certainty that we want. It points us in a certain direction, and then decisions need to be made. So for an example with COVID-19, there's no precise science on what effect masks have on transmission. It's the general consensus is that it reduces it, but it needs to be layered with additional, you know, social distancing and things like that as well too. With climate change, right, the front on the war on climate change is about the science, the legitimacy of the science. And there are certainly some crackpots out there sort of cherry picking evidence one way or another. But I really think that the widespread concern is that you have these industries where it's an existential threat, right? Where you're working in a global environment where, you know, there are others who are not following the same rules, and it's cheaper for them not to follow the same rules. Only instead of addressing the issue and addressing the transition that needs to occur for these companies, that they don't have a place in a warming world, the argument's been shifted to the science. And so that's where the argument is. That's where the fight is happening right now. But I don't think that it's really about getting people to believe in the science. I think they're grasping at an argument to try and survive in a world that doesn't have a place for them anymore.
Well, Jeff, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Jeff Slegomelch, Deputy Director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Earth Institute. And we have been talking about his new book called Rethinking Readiness, A Brief Guide to 21st Century Mega Disasters. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
A legal ID. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and I am Dr. Demento, just barely legal.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
1, 2, 3, 4.